So this evening, the theme is truthfulness, translated to English. In the Pali, it's actually satya, which more technically is translated as truth itself. But as a aspiration towards Buddhahood, I think it's how we practice it or how we can develop it is through truthfulness. Actually, there is kind of at least three aspects to it. I mean, maybe you can say that at the very base, the very kind of source, there needs to be an aspiration towards truth, kind of a fundamental aspiration towards truth in order for one to step onto the spiritual path, not to mention the spiritual path towards Buddhahood. Very focused, or very intense aspiration towards truth. And then there is how we actually can maybe cultivate it in a more practical sense through acts and through attitudes of truthfulness, honesty, integrity. And then there is how it's actually presented more formally, or what the kind of more realization part of it is within terms of the Buddha's teachings. So that then there, when it comes to that part, satya becomes the arya satya, the noble truths. And while this, at least the formalities of it are usually expressed in the Buddhist way, but there is some fundamental truths in it, universal truths. So first of all, maybe the on the aspiration level, you know, that aspiration towards Buddhahood in its, you know, as a theme, general theme of these 10 talks, and aspiration towards spiritual practice. I think one needs some kind of a interest, at least, if not a real aspiration towards truth. That's what the kind of was the kind of archetypal, if you like, message in the life of the Buddha when he came across the limitations of old age, sickness, and death. Then he was kind of confounded by this. What is this anyway? And I think just it's sort of I say archetypal because I think we all have probably experienced that to some degree. Remember when my my aunt or my granny died? You know, and they said, "Oh, she died." And I said, "Yeah, well, anymore? She died. What does that mean?" "Well, she's no more. She's gone off to," I think I was quite young, so she'd gone off to heaven or a long holiday somewhere. I knew Granny did not go for long holidays anywhere. She's bedridden for most of her life, that I knew her anyway, so it was this euphemism for she's dead and gone. Then I really couldn't understand that, what that meant to me. So I think, to me, the life, this kind of symbols in the life of the Buddha are really, to me, they're kind of archetypical images of all of us, which we all face at some time or other. Some of us earlier than later, some of us not till later. And we get a bit older, and then we realize, hey, this is serious now. This thing called life is serious. I am actually getting old. Not just my grandmother. Starts to hit home then. That's why they're frequently called in the Buddhist teachings the heavenly messengers. That, you know, in the worldly sense, old age, sickness, and death for most people is something to be ignored, something to be hidden away. You know, somebody's sick, you hide them away in the hospital. If somebody's old, they hide them away in the old people's home or something. And death, whoop, anybody seen that? Quick, get them out of the way. And yet, in the spiritual sense, these are heavenly messengers. And in the kind of story of the life of the Buddha, I don't know if many of you know about it, but he was supposedly led a very sheltered life. And then it occurred to him to go out and, you know, look around the countryside, but he was sheltered, very, very sheltered from all the difficulties of life, hardships of life. But the heavenly beings sent a message in the form of an old person and a sick person and then a corpse. And you can say maybe, you know, in one sense, again, kind of, I don't know, archetypically, heavenly is sort of, you know, up there somewhere, just like Brahma Sahampati asked the Buddha to teach. You know, it's a symbol. It's not necessarily there is a person up there, but it's more like there is a symbol, symbolic of some higher force or some higher power or some higher truth is teaching us something. So you can look at, some people can look at old age, sickness and death as a kind of a, you know, something, so like a sign of failure or something to be, you know, pitied or denied or something ignored. Or you can look at it as something very, a messenger, a very important messenger, telling us some very profound truth of life. And then the third, the fourth of these symbols was the Buddha saw the spiritual seeker, the so-called mendicant. And that was the way. They were the ones who were trying to find the answer to this, these unresolved existential questions of life. What's the meaning of life? And it was various spiritual paths to follow. And likewise, I think in any spiritual practice, maybe not so dramatic or colorful maybe, but probably if we look at the real heart of what is motivating us in spiritual practice, isn't there something like truth or something in it? A bit vague sometimes, because truth is like such a, you know, vague concept. And in one of the scriptures, there also is this differentiation between relative truth and ultimate truth. And they can get sometimes very mixed up. You know, just like you can try to find out what the truth of a situation is in a relative sense. But maybe in a higher sense, it's quite different. You know, like old age, sickness, and death, for example. You know, at a relative level, it is a sign of failure. You know, to the ego, to my ego, which is, you know, me, I'm great, I'm wonderful, with the kind of connotations of, you know, I'm going to live forever and be immortal. You know, the ego does not like to hear that it's not immortal. So at a relative level, old age, sickness and death is a bit of a sign of failure to the ego. But in the ultimate sense, that's the truth. It depends how we look at it. And then the aspiration towards truth. I mean, because there is different definitions and there's different ways that people, practically speaking, perceive or realize truth. It's, to me, the image I have is like the fuel. It's the fuel in the vehicle which takes us to on the spiritual path. It motivates us. It fuels us. It keeps us going. In my own experience is that, you know, people have different interpretations or different, maybe you could say, connections with truth. Sometimes their truth, I think, is defined more in terms of more like comfort, what is more comfortable to themselves at certain levels of being. So, for example, some people come to spiritual practice from a sense of some kind of suffering or hurt or crisis. And to them, then, their truth is how to resolve this or overcome this crisis or this suffering. And once that truth has been resolved, that's the end of their spiritual path. Others, maybe they have some kind of either a very deep experience or they have some deep questioning within them. And just having some degree of suffering or crisis resolved in her life is not the end of it. You know, if somebody explains to me, okay, grandmother died, and they say, well, dying means the body breaks up and no longer functions, and yeah, but okay, that's rationally, that makes sense. But what is this the real meaning of life? Just to be born, live for 70, 80, 90 years and then die? Huh? Is that it? At the end of the story? Well, you say, well, we do feed the worms, you know. Look at the positive side of it. or we go up to heaven or somewhere. We go off and we just kind of, we transmigrate and get reborn again. You know, there's always that hope. Huh? So it's not a total waste. You get recycled, huh? You kind of So they're kind of spiritual recycling, say. So. It does sound a little bit more hopeful than just, that's it, finished, you know, a nihilist, that's finished. And then the Buddha brought in this concept of truth, awakening to truth, ultimate reality. And there is this aspiration, and maybe it can be helpful if we were to, you know, investigate within us, you know, what is my commitment to truth, or, you know, what is really motivating my spiritual practice? How committed or how serious am I about trying to really discover truth? Then maybe when that, if you notice your energy, your commitment kind of flagging a bit, maybe what it requires is a readjustment of that. You know, because as I mentioned, there are many different concepts. Truth, you know, as an ultimate experience, I can only presume we haven't realized it yet. Huh? The best we can do is have a concept about it. But as we begin to practice and even just live a life, you know, my idea of what truth is has changed considerably in 35 years as a monk, or even when I was a child, I think, it's changed considerably. And if we maybe are at least a bit more flexible and adaptable and allow ourselves to, you know, investigate, contemplate, and be open enough to change our perception of what this truth is, then maybe we can rekindle, or we can refuel our spiritual aspirations. I know, I think I would say I have met people who have come to spiritual practice, and some have come to be monks or nuns and had great aspirations, and then somehow it just kind of faded out. And I think for some of them, you know, maybe their idea, their concept, their image of what realization or awakening or spiritual truth was perhaps maybe not well developed or not well grounded or something. You know, people have these kind of ideas, you know, if I just sit there and meditate, you know, for a few years, and the lights start coming and the bells start happening, and you know, enlightenment starts to kind of happen. And then what happens is, you know, it's not the lights, it's more like seeing your own mind and all of its tricks it plays on you, the confusion it brings up, and say, hey, where's the enlightenment in that? The enlightenment of that is just seeing it as just phenomena, just conditioned phenomena. That's not the whole picture. But if you don't understand that, and we haven't got enough, maybe, you know, spiritual support or enough momentum or not flexible enough, and when it starts to get difficult, and my experience is when the practice gets difficult, that's actually a very positive sign. That's a sign that you're beginning to actually, there's some realization of the truth of non-self is beginning to be accessed, and then the self is starting to panic. It's starting to throw up all kinds of stuff to distract you and throw you off the path. However, a bit hard to, you know, it's not easy to put up with, unless one has something like, you know, some of these qualities of commitment to truth, patience from last week, and has some energy and wisdom in the previous weeks, and it can carry us through. We haven't pinned all our hopes on just a concept or ideal of awakening. When it doesn't happen, we give up. We realize that's not the truth then. It's only an image of truth. And we can broaden our perspective then. We can broaden our base to give us a little bit, some other supports to keep us going in spiritual practice. And as well as the aspiration, there is the development of truthfulness. And it's very easy to say, I think, oh yes, truthfulness, but actually put it into practice. You know, this is, you can say, perhaps most clearly or formally expressed in the fourth of the fifth precepts, refraining from untruthfulness, musavada, literally means refraining from wrong speech. I translate it as refraining from wrong communication. Because you can also, You know, you can also lie to oneself through your mind and through your actions too. Not just speech. Speech is one way. And of course, speech does involve other people, so maybe it's one to be especially careful of. You can think all kinds of confused thoughts and nobody else knows, but when you put them into your mouth, oops, everybody hears about it. You can do action, it gets even more destructive. I remember once in America, somebody asked me, which is the hardest precept to follow? And then I realized that the fourth one, truthfulness, is the hardest one to follow. To me, anyway. Other ones, in a sense, are, to me, a little bit of an extension of non-truthfulness. But it sounds so simple. Or to refrain from lying. It sounds very simple. But it's not just telling a lie. I mean, if you really look at it practically, it's distortions, misunderstanding, you know. Till it gets to the point where we can say that unless you've realized the absolute truth, you're lying all the time. Oops. Bit of a hard one, isn't it? Unless we realized and really understand the truth, then all our body, speech, and action is lying. Because we're not totally in harmony with the truth. We haven't realized it yet. Don't know what it is. Okay, maybe it's not lying, you know, in that sense you've heard from your school first grade school teacher, don't tell a lie. But it's distortion, it's misperception, misunderstanding, stretching the truth a bit, you know, because we don't realize what the real truth is. And so it's always a distortion in some form or other. So to be able to practice truthfulness, I mean, can be quite a demanding practice, actually. To bring attention, first of all, to our speech, and then our actions, and then our states of mind. I mean, if you're just observing your states of mind, for example, wow, I mean, you begin to realize just how powerful and how persistent self-delusion is. You're lying to yourself. You're wonderful. No, no. You're terrible. You're stupid. You're intelligent. You're and none of them are the truth, actually, but because there's no I there in the first place. It's all off. You know. Then to try and actually practice this in our, you know, what all these expressions of untruthfulness. If you look at them, what's the source of them? Yeah, they go back to our self-image again, back to myself. You know, I stretch the truth because I want to impress somebody. You know, I stretch the truth because I want to somehow prop up my ego. I want to support it. I want to give it a little bit better, nicer picture than it really is. Or, you know, if you look at the back of it, woo, there's all this self-preservation in one form or another. So first of all, what we can do is to bring attention to how it spills out, I say, in body, speech, and mind, in our bodily actions, in our speech, in our states of mind. That's something we can do with mindfulness, developing more mindfulness around just what we do, say, and think. Very practical exercise. And especially be able to see the interconnection. You know, as one of Ajahn Chah's sayings was, if I translate it from Thai, he said, you do what you say and say what you do. Otherwise, they call you a dirty wise man. As most of us realize, it's very easy to say things, you know, speak these high ideals, but to live up to them. Yeah. I'm just reading about Mahatma Gandhi. And my goodness, he struggled all his life to put his high ideals into practice in his everyday life. Not only for himself, but running an ashram and then politics in India. My goodness, pretty heavy duty practice. And one of his primary principles was what's called satyagraha, truth force, the force of truth. Which was, to him, it was primarily based upon total harmlessness, nonviolence and harmlessness. And when he got all this, you know, all this resistance and trying to coordinate all these different views and opinions in politics, you know, and still maintain harmlessness. But he had a belief that this had a force to it. See, it was a force to truth. And I can talk about this more next week in the theme of resolution. But if one has a commitment to truth, there's a certain power to it. It gives us an inner strength. Because, you know, people, outside situations can judge you, they can blame you, they can criticize you, but you look in your heart, nothing's moving. Because I am true to myself. And especially, you know, when we get to difficult situations, when we do feel weakened by, say, old age, sickness, and death, you can look in your heart and your heart's at peace because you live with truth. It's harmony with truth as best you can. It gives you an extra support in your life. It gives you an extra support in your spiritual practice. It gives you some inner strength, my commitment to truth. And especially in the, you know, when it comes to something like the final moments passing away, when you're, you know, you're only with you and your maker, or just yourself in Buddhism, sorry, no maker. That's when you value the support of truthfulness in your life. If you live the life based on truthfulness, then nothing can bother you. You can just go into the white light and you're off. And then there is, of course, the developing truthfulness as a basis for our life allows us to really be able to have some commitment to and ability to see things as they really are. You know, you say, yatta bhuta jnanadasanam, to really knowledge and vision of the way things really are. I think if we've always been living a life fooling ourselves, very hard to be truthful with yourself, hard to see the way things really are, because the way things really are beyond yourself. And if you've been fooling yourself, and you've been a prey to the games that yourself is playing on you and fooling you all the time, never going to be able to see through it, to the way things really are, the non-self, the truth of non-self then. And this is formally expressed in the Four Noble Truths. This is called the Arya Satcha, the Noble Truths, the Four Noble Truths. And the very first one, the Noble Truth of Unsatisfactoriness. I mean, how many people are really willing to actually observe that? Really, really honestly able to acknowledge unsatisfactoriness? Yeah, it sounds like just a kind of a bad story, you know? Life is unsatisfactory. Life is incomplete. I mean, that's a heavy one. You know, it should end like one of those, you know, fairy stories, you know, happily ever after. But, oops, nope. Unsatisfactoriness is an ultimate truth. But the kind of irony of it is, when you really begin to look at that and go into it, then you realize the real peace, because that's the way it really is. The Buddha's not giving us another story to counteract the fairy tale. He's telling us the truth. This noble truth of unsatisfactoriness is what the Buddha awoke to. He was enlightened to this reality, this truth of the way things are. So he's just giving us, out of compassion, he's giving us this reminder, hey, look at this aspect of life. Most of us don't want to see it. We keep ignoring it all the time. That's why we developed a pattern of ignorance. We've been ignoring this truth. And the Buddha says, you know, unsatisfactoriness, remind yourself of that as a theme for contemplation. But it's not the whole story, of course. Yeah, it's unsatisfactoriness, but it's not an ultimate thing. It's got a cause to it. There's a cause. The second truth is the cause of suffering, unsatisfactoriness, in the conventional sense. Then there is a cessation of it. Then there is a path to follow. So In a way, this is like a bit of like a diagnosis of our situation. Here we are in our human condition. It's unsatisfactory, but there's a cause to it. The cause is craving, our desire to have things, you know, which are not the way they really are. We're craving for things to be different than they really are. So we see that, remove the cause of this suffering. In a way, not much has really changed. On the other side, a lot has changed. There's still old age, sickness, and death, but there's not the attachment, the craving, the delusion that it shouldn't be this way. It's the way it is. So with that realization of truth, there's incredible peace arises. Just the way it is. How could it be otherwise? What before then was a kind of a relative tragedy now becomes an ultimate realization. You know, totally transformed. We're still going to get old and sick and die, but now with complete peace. Doesn't mean it goes away. You know, before I used to think, oh, when I'm enlightened, I'll live forever, actually. You know, probably some people believe that. I think, oh, Nibbana must be immortality then. You know? It's just another, you know, kind of exalted spiritual ego trip, you know. See, that it's not like the old death. You know, when you're enlightened, you live forever in Nibbana, some place called Nibbana. See, up there, just beyond Mount Ruhapehu, somewhere, maybe Cape Rienga, isn't it? Watch out for that one, see. The Buddha was teaching a middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. See. Otherwise, some people keep talking about, usually they talk about it in Buddhism on the other side, you know. It's all nothing. Nothing there, see. As soon as you die, it's nothing. You're annihilated. No, that's not it either. Yeah. The Buddha was teaching a middle way between these extremes. Not eternal bliss in Nibbana, not total extinction in annihilationism either. But it was a freedom, a liberation from unsatisfactoriness as we normally understand it. It's kind of paradoxical in a way, and we really investigate unsatisfactoriness and see it as it really is. It's not unsatisfactory anymore. We go into suffering and really understand it and see it as it really is. It's not suffering anymore. Because it's a shift in our whole consciousness now. We're now in harmony with the truth rather than resisting it as a truth. You know, so to be able to try and, you know, follow this aspiration, you know, first of all to perhaps tune into what this aspiration towards truth means for you and your spiritual practice. I remember myself, I've often asked myself, you know, why am I interested in spiritual practice? Because, you know, most of my family has no interest. You know? And I don't know, still, sometimes I have these images sometime, long time ago, thinking about some, you know, truth seeker up in the Himalayas somewhere, and seeking to find the ultimate truth. And, you know, I'm still looking for it. See, I tried the Swiss Alps, and I tried the Himalayas, and I now I come to the Southern Alps, and the Rimutaka Hills, and it's got to be there somewhere. And then how we can actually cultivate truthfulness in our life, you know, in practical ways. You know, if we, you know, if we don't recognize that, then actually we live our life kind of untruthful in a way, supporting the ego and all of its expressions, lying to ourselves through body, speech, and mind. You know, how is we ever going to create the right conditions to be able to see through that? See the ultimate truth. If we're still being distracted and distorted by the relative truth all the time of ego. So we'd be actually trying to put it into our life. I mean, the Buddha gave much emphasis to truthfulness, you know, the keeping of the precept, you know, and interestingly enough, you know, when he talks about people acknowledging their mistakes, you know, there's a frequent reference in the scripture when people made mistakes, And the Buddha said, oh, this is very good to acknowledge your mistake. Somebody who can acknowledge their mistake as a mistake, then they can correct it. You know, they can transform themselves. They can reestablish themselves in truth. If you don't know you're lying to ourselves, oops, we really are lying to ourselves. We don't even know it. At least if you know it, you're halfway there. See? Then how to correct it now? Recognize, hey, it's not so skillful to continue with that. And then maybe we begin to then recognize is how this provides a foundation for clearer seeing of what's really happening, deeper insight into the Four Noble Truths. We begin to get that kind of perspective then, just we realize that, you know, now our practice is actually beginning to penetrate into the truth in a much more ultimate way. Before, you know, it was, you know, in modern society to talk about philosophy, the love of truth. But philosophy, the love of truth? Well, in spiritual practice, it's not just loving the truth, you have to actually practice it, realize it, experience it for oneself. Not just to have sophistry about it, talk about it, but to actually experience it directly. And the Buddha, as a meditator, realized that only by the development of these qualities, the sharpening of the mind, you know, the developing of mindfulness and concentration beyond the limitations of the conceptual mind, gives a possibility for this deeper penetration into the way things really are. So it starts off as an aspiration towards truth, and then trying to actually cultivate it, bring it into a practical application development in our life, brings into focus and the realization. Begin to get some deeper insight into the true reality of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. Those are the ultimate truths. And once we begin to recognize, just, you know, at least in some level, the truthfulness, the reality of those, and it's a matter of deepening that awareness into our life continuously. It's not a matter of the Buddha saying, oh, you know, this is the real way things are. I mean, he's giving us some guidance in that direction. But he had this realization of truth himself, saying this is how it is ultimately. He's not just talking about it or kidding us about it. That's the way it really is. Then he's given us the tools to use for us to experience that too. So it becomes an aspiration towards truth, you know, with the continued practice and continuity in the spiritual path becomes a direct realization ourselves then. And in a way, you know, life goes on, but in a different attitude now. Living in harmony with the truth. And then begin to see there is less friction, less dissonance in our life, if you like. More harmony. We live in harmony with that. People can read about it. You can read about the Buddha's explanation of truth. And I think some people even had some kind of insights. But unless it's really integrated into our life, in body, speech, and mind, you know, it's hard to actually live that constantly, continuously, you know, 24/7. We just have little glimpses here and there, and you know, it can keep us going, but the real possibility is there to bring it into our life continuously. If we can ground it in observing our body, speech, and mind, and how close we are, and you know, to living that example, that truth in our life continuously. So satya is one of the aspirations, one of the foundations for Buddhahood. It's a bit like last week's theme, patience. It's not one of the ones that kind of stands out, you know, not like wisdom. I mean, you could say that the true maturing of truthfulness results in wisdom then. It results in the wisdom. You know? But you can have an aspiration towards wisdom, I guess. Yeah, but what the Buddha is pointing at is this aspiration towards truthfulness, truth in its widest sense. When we begin to understand truth, that's what I would say is wisdom then. We really understand what truth is. Wisdom is the flourishing or the kind of blossoming of truthfulness manifesting in our life So as a kind of a foundation, is what this aspiration, I mean, the Buddha had, of course, I guess you'd say, the ultimate aspiration towards truth in order to realize Buddhahood. You know, most of us just need a little bit of aspiration to be enlightened, you see. If you want to realize Buddhahood, that's even more complete aspiration to truthfulness. It's like, in a way, aspiring to know everything. Where the arahant, all you need the aspiration towards realize the Four Noble Truths. You don't have to know everything. You don't have to be an omniscient Buddha. So to be able to keep that going in our life, and hopefully we cultivate it, becomes a much more stable foundation in our practice, and we began to kind of build the foundations, you know, patience, truthfulness, energy, and we keep aspiring, keep building the right conditions that will allow Buddhahood to actually manifest. And it's kind of ironic, actually. I can't make Buddhahood, because Buddhahood's beyond I. All we can do is create the right conditions that it manifests. And once we bring them all together, and it's like putting all the parts of the puzzle together, see? Now we've got, what, about seven or something? Seven parts of the puzzle have come together, you know, before Buddhahood. Just three more. Getting closer. Picture's coming together. So I think I should pause there.